Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is powered by Bikeshaw. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to your exact needs, helping you save money on your annual bike, scooter and moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Now, they said it would never last, Pruts, but here we are. I can't believe I'm saying that. We are back and it is series three of Full Chat.
Who'd have thought it, my friend? Me and you and I, talking absolute cobblers for a living about our favourite topic, which is, of course, motorcycles, my friend.
And not only that, we get to meet some absolute inspirational people, some wonderful people, heroes of ours, and today is an absolute belter. We are starting series three, let's be honest, with someone who we've wanted since series one, and we finally got him. Go on, Prats, do the honours.
Well, they don't get much better than this in the world of two wheels, because our guest today is an actor, a TV presenter, a travel writer, an all-round entertainer, the ultimate modern-day adventurer, and on a self-indulgent note, a man who lit a fire under my 20-something self for all things motorbikes. It is, of course, the one and only Mr. Charlie Bowman.
Wow. I'm not sure I can live up to that.
You will. That's a strong intro, mate. You deserve a strong intro. Seriously, we have wanted God. You since literally episode one. We said we've got to get Charlie on. And I've had the honour of actually meeting you and riding with you. And I've got to say, not only are you a wonderful, lovely bloke with some great stories, but you know your way around a bike and you can certainly handle one. Crikey, when we went riding around your way, I was like, slow down a bit, wait for me. You know what you're doing.
No, not at all. I think it's just pure luck. I think you just go to a corner and just, you know, I think I'm too thick to slow down. So I just, you know, and as my wife says, well, you know, I suppose you've got to be good at something. So she does. No, I mean, it is. Listen, it's fun. I think one of the things that I've noticed all my life of riding motorbikes are the friendships that I've made over the years, and the amount of people that I see, you know, on a daily basis, all kind of ride motorcycles, and so there is this kind of sort of fraternity of people, and I'm sure people who ride horses or go climbing or cycling or, you know, whatever it is, they all, you know, are like-minded, so that creates this sort of community. But everywhere you go around the world, you know, it's you can just dial into those people. It's wonderful.
In the intro, Charlie, I talked about, because on this we've spoken to so many wonderful people, and this passion for motorcycles. The common theme is it starts early on. Now, mine was slightly different, where I came to it a bit later, but given the fact that we're knocking on the door of 20 years of long way around, I was living down in Southampton with a very close friend of mine, one of my best mates called Grennan, who we were sat with the box set, and it was one of those where we'll watch one, we'll watch another one. Well, and we sat there solidly for what felt like quite a long time, getting through it. And what it did for me was open up a world that I had never really kind of delved into, not just the motorcycle side of it, the places that you went, Road of Bones, Magadan, places that literally were on the other side of the planet. And the fact that you got to do it on a motorcycle, or not got to do it, had the sheer front to think, do you know what? We'll go that way around. Even though there's a big old ocean in that particular way of going. It was just... I mean, it was just the most glorious and inspirational thing. So first of all, thank you. Wow. It's given me so much in my life moving forward from that. But for you, where was the inspiration for that? How do you dream so big to be able to do that?
Well, I do sit here asking myself how I got here. But and I think, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, it started for me. I mean, I started very young riding motorcycles. I was 5 or 6 years old, and I remember my great friend Jason, a guy called Jason Connery, who I've been friends with since I was sort of 6 or 7 years old. My father is a film director, and he made films like Deliverance, Excalibur, and Hope and Glory, and all sorts of movies, and he made a movie with Sean Connery, or back then, a film called Zardoz. And I don't know if you Google Sean Connery and Zardoz, he wears this outfit that it looks like he's wearing a nappy, you've seen it, I'm sure. Well, anyway, if whoever's watching or listening to this podcast, you know, while you're listening, Google Sean Connery in Zardoz, or and it's priceless. But he just finished doing Bond, and he wanted to get away from Bond and do something different. And wow, he really fucking did. But he and it was so and his son was and they made it in Ireland, and Sean was living in our house while they were filming, and someone had left a little Honda monkey bike in the barn, and Jason had found it, and Jason made me, at 6 or 7 years old, made me push this motorbike up and down this hill to try and get it started. And we finally got it started. Jason had a go, and he finally let me have a go. And I remember going up the hill, and Dad and Sean were standing on the lawn, and I went shooting past them. And as I went shooting past them, sort of going, "Look at me," and my dad reached out and he grabbed me by the hair and he pulled me off
Oh,
the bike,
Jesus.
right? And I'm left there hanging there like this by my hair, and the bike just piled into a barbed wire fence. And
God.
so that was my first experience of riding motorcycles, and then it just went on from there. And then, you know, my mate Tommy Rochford, who was the guy who was a real inspiration, he had a Mako 400, which at the time, that was the bike to have. Beautiful, still a beautiful bike. And I convinced him to give me a go around a field, and I fell off again. And that's been the theme of my life, actually.
I was going to say, you
I've
say
just
about getting
back crashed
on.
Everything.
Yeah, you say about the theme of your life has fallen off. You've obviously made some amazing friendships, but I saw on your socials the other day you actually were talking about one of your worst crashes in South Africa, I think it was. And you've done some serious damage on bikes, but it doesn't seem to put you off. You love them, and I'm assuming as long as you can, you will always ride motorbikes.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think it's in. I think it's like everybody. I mean, I used to ride a lot of horses as well, and I think you know, all those people keep falling off and getting back on and stuff. So I suppose it's just a passion, isn't it? Anyway, so that's kind of how it sort of started, and then I've just never stopped riding. And in actual fact, what's really good about it is they say, you know, everyone talks about mental health and everything these days, and how important it is, and how important mental health is, and then they say that, you know, that there's evidence of, you know, riding motorcycles is a really good way. You know, if you've had a long, hard day at work, you get on your motorbike and you ride home, and by the time you get home, you've cleared your mind, and it's a great thing. So I think all of us who ride motorbikes have been doing mental health. I've been doing mental health since I was 6 years old without even realizing. So you know, I'm in a great shape. I'm in a great place.
Charlie, we mentioned Long Way Round as the kind of jump off point for where you find yourself now professionally, of course, given what it's kind of mushroomed into. But long way up, long way down, you know, long way, you know what I mean, everywhere that you've been, and obviously there's inklings potentially of another one on the way. From a purely, and you talk about the mental health side of it and getting on a bike, which is the most wonderful thing. From a logistical point of view, the planning of these things, you see it in the documentaries, and you see, I mean, it's so, I mean, different countries, different languages, different traditions, different cultures. Does it ever feel too daunting from the start? You think, you look at your mate and you go, Christ almighty, this is a lot of work. Or is it always that as soon as you nudge the bike forward, that's a feeling that you think about, because then in theory, you're off and you're free.
Yeah, I mean, I think always all these things that you look at, and all the things that we've all done in the past, you know, the people see the kind of more the kind of end result, but you know, there is a lot more work behind the scenes than people actually think, and you know, to get a long way going, or any of the TV shows that I've done, the By Any Means, the Extreme Frontiers, Race to Dakar, all of the ones I've done, you know, they take two or three years to do from start to finish, and so you know, there's a lot of begging for money, there's a lot of convincing people that it's a really good idea, and then yeah, absolutely, you know, dealing with lots of different countries and languages and stuff. But that's part of it. And I remember when years ago, it's just gone over 20 years since we did the first one. And I remember we were doing some work with ex-SAS people, ex-Special Forces, and doing training, hostile environmental training and stuff to get ourselves ready for, you know, there was no real dramas really of that kind. But it was great fun to do it. But he said, look, if you can get through the prep, the adventure is easy. And that's the payoff, you know. So, you know, the hardest thing in the world is to stick to a leaving date, you know, and if you can do that and you can survive all the preparation and everything, then your reward is the adventure.
Yeah.
And I have to say that there's been plenty of times where I've sat there, you know, opening the tent in the morning and thinking, what the fuck is going to happen today? You know, and because it really every day something happened, you know, and you know, and I remember the first time when we were trying to convince people, to do the TV show, you know, Long Way Round. And people weren't getting it. It was relatively easy to get the book deal. You know, two guys going around the world, not knowing what's going to happen. You know, and that idea actually seemed to go quite well. And we were quite pumped, thinking, yeah, we'll get a TV show out of this now as well. Nobody understood it. And I remember Ewan was making Star Wars in Australia, so we flew down to Australia to make a little pilot. You know. So we could get, people could get the idea of what we were doing, because I don't think anyone had really done what we'd done, and so no one really understood what we're trying to do. So we went down there, did the little pilot that we used to try and get a TV deal, and we thought while we're down there we'd go to Channel 8 or Channel 10, I can't remember, and see if we could pitch the idea and see if they'd get involved. Anyway, we pitched the idea in Sydney to this guy, and we sat down, we told him what was going to happen, and you know, all this kind of stuff, and we weren't sure what was going to happen, but something was going to happen and stuff like that. And he said at the end of the pitch, he said, well, do you want to know what I really think? And we said, yeah, no, we'd really, really, really like to know. And he goes, I think two wankers on motorcycles.
Brilliant.
And that was
you should have called it
said,
that.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, two wankers, and I'm sure lots of people have, but then a year and a half later we sold it to them for a fortune. So and then I was down in Australia like a year and a half later doing promotions, and they've done this whole breakfast show about it in the morning. And so I went down and I asked the reception if I can't remember his name, John or Stephen or whatever it was, or Joey or something.
Joey.
And he apparently he wasn't there. So
lives and dies by decisions. Yeah. Awful decision to pass on that.
when you do these adventures, Charlie, obviously you and you can see it on screen, you've got that childhood friendship, you love each other, and that's really important. We had another mate of yours on there, Billy Ward, who is a bundle of joy as well. I mean, it must, I'm assuming, be essential when you do these adventures, you don't want to be stuck with someone you don't get on with, because yes, you've got that common bond of bikes, and yes, you've got that familiarity and respect for one another, but you're away for a long time. You've got to like these people, be like-minded.
Yeah, you do. I mean, absolutely. I mean, luckily I only see Billy once or so a year. So that's okay. No, Billy's great. Billy Ward is the guy we're mentioning who's been on your podcast, and he helps me with I do these motorcycle tours every year. So every year we go to Australia and we do a Melbourne to Sydney tour via Tasmania. It's brilliant. It's a 10-day tour and it's fantastic. And that's great fun, but it's very true. I've heard lots of stories. When we first started doing the trip together, people said, "Look, you know, you guys might not get on, and you'll only know that when you start traveling together." And luckily enough, you and I kind of got on with each other. I don't know if we'd shared a car together for 4.5 months. I'm not sure how that would have been. But you know what's really interesting, and I'm sure you guys have found it as well. And I'm sure when we rode together, we found it as well that you know, you could have two or three people going down the same road, and at the end of the ride, all two of you or three of you or four of you have had a kind of a different experience on that same piece of road, you know, and you stop and you say, God, did you see that waterfall on the left-hand side there? Wasn't it beautiful? And you go, oh, no, I missed that. But did you see the lake? And you go, no, I didn't see. You know what I mean? So you're all seeing different things. And so at the end of each day, you know, you're sort of almost catching up with each other when you have a sort of a debrief about your trip, which is lovely. But I've met people who've gone off on motorcycle trips together and after a period of time have decided to just go their own way, and they just, you know, didn't get on. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it happens, and it doesn't happen very often, but it does happen.
I think that's the great thing about, because the most of the touring that I've done has been on my own, Charlie, because I don't have many mates. But that then means that you're at your own behest then. So if things go wrong, there's only you to blame. If you're dragging ass, there's only you to blame. But on the flip side of it is, if you get somewhere, you're like, oh no, I've done it on my own, it's great and all that. And obviously on your own, you've got your sat nav and all that. But I can totally get that. It's funny you should say about a book deal, and I've not remotely set this up, right? This is not a fake wallpaper, and this is going to be terrible if you're listening to it and you're not watching. But look, this is...
Oh, the coffee table book.
Your actual book here. And so I was living in Cheltenham about 15 years ago, and my sister-in-law managed to get this signed by you. Now, I'm not saying you have to remember that, because that's a ridiculous thing.
I remember her well in Cheltenham. Yeah.
Perhaps you're about to find out that Charlie didn't sign it. Your sister-in-law signed it for you.
Yes. I mean, that's not my signature. That is your
signature. No, that's not me.
So, David, wishing you all the best on your very own long way around. Happy Christmas. Be good. Charlie Borman. There you go. You see? Oh,
wow. So how amazing. Well,
that was a gift, so I didn't buy it.
Thank you, sister. Yeah. Well, if you could find an unsigned book, it'd probably be worth a lot of money.
And once again, it just reaffirms what it's done, the kind of appeal that it's got. And you mentioned about the business with Billy. I mean, Billy was wonderful. I think we asked him one question, and then 45 minutes later, Ewan and I went, cheers, Billy. Thanks for that. Thanks. Wonderful to have you on. Yeah, he's great. An absolute force of nature, that man. But the business and the passion that you've got for it, it's something via your website that people can come to you and join and explore the world with yourself and Billy, can't they?
Yeah, no, they can. I mean, it all came, that doing the motorcycle tours, we do a tour in Africa as well, from Cape Town to Victoria Falls. And we've done that for 12 or 13 years now. And it all came from, because I kept meeting people and they kept saying, oh, you know, if you ever did a ride, I'd love to ride with you. And then you would talk about going through Africa, and people, the minute you say Africa or you Kenya or something, and they go, oh no, Africa's dangerous. And so they see Africa as one country, and it's actually a continent of, you know, many, many countries. And I think it gets a bit of a bad rub. You know, people say, oh no, that's a dangerous place. And you go, is it? And they go, oh yeah, terribly dangerous. And you say, have you been there? And they go, no. You know, so I think I remember one time I was down in Cape Town, and this friend of mine rang me up and he said, God, there's Ebola in Africa. You've got to get out of Africa. And I said, well, hang on a minute, where is it? And he goes, well, it's up in the west coast of Africa near Senegal. And I said, well, actually, if you look on the map, I said, you're closer than I am.
No way.
And he went, oh my God, he said, it's coming our way. So, you know, so that's a classic example of something's happening somewhere and they just assume it's the whole of Africa. So the idea of doing the tours and getting people out was to sort of say, look, it is possible and it's not as scary as people think it is. And you know, get out there and ride the world.
Where's been your favourite place so far then? You've obviously been lucky enough to ride some amazing routes, I've no doubt, see some beautiful sights. Is it South Africa? Yeah. What's the one place, when you daydream away, I want to get out on my bike, where's the place you go to?
Oh, well, I think I've been very lucky and ridden quite a lot. But I think the African continent is my favorite, and I think you know, because if you go down to Morocco, which is super easy to get to from the UK, you know, you can take the boat to Santander through Portugal, and then down into Spain, and there's a short boat ride, and you're in North Africa, and North Africa is you know, it's very Arab, it's completely different to what people would think Africa is, and culturally and religiously it's totally different. And then you get down to Central Africa and it changes completely again, and then down into Southern Africa it's a completely different place as well. So culturally and religiously it completely changes the whole way through, and it's the only continent left, especially when you're heading towards more the middle and South Africa, so Southern Africa, where it's just full of animals, and I've done it with Billy on our motorcycle tours, where we've had to stop because 60 elephants are crossing the road, and you're just waiting, and then some of the clients after this 16-day tour, some of them go, if I see another fucking elephant crossing the road, and oh my god, you know, and you go, well, hang on a minute, because 10 days ago you'd never seen an elephant, yeah. You know, and then you see giraffe and kudu, and sometimes you'd be riding along and suddenly an ostrich starts running beside you, and it's full of people and full of adventure, you know, whereas South America is stunningly beautiful and I love it, but it's very empty. Hmm. You know, and to go from one place to the next is huge distances, whereas in Africa, you know, around every corner there's a new adventure. And bizarrely, right now, you know, you can do the whole west coast of Africa now. Suddenly it's open. And then there's bits of East Africa now, which is a bit more difficult to get through. So in the 20 years of riding in Africa, the whole thing has changed as to where you can and can't ride. Mm. So it's a super fascinating place.
A quick bit of mid-show housekeeping, folks. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. Charlie, what you've just said there about getting to places and seeing places, I'm totally on board with the Morocco thing, because I took a motorbike down there myself. And it, like you say, in your head and being a Yorkshireman, Morocco felt to me like the closest far away place in the kind of patch of time that I could get to. And it was one of those.
And as a Yorkshireman, it probably suited your budget as well, didn't it?
I slept on top of my bike. That's what I did.
I know how stingy you guys are. So, you know.
It's all true, mate. It's all true. And it was that thing of a totally, like on a short boat ride, a totally different culture. Even you look at your phone and suddenly your 4 or 3G goes and it's suddenly, it feels a bit different now. And that very first time when you are kind of feeling the fresh and given, as I've said to you, and been more than fanboying about it, in your head you are thinking of your own trip that you're doing, and then the first time you see something that is completely alien, like going down the road and there's a camel, a proper double take, I thought, bloody hell, I mean, obviously that's a camel, but you don't get many camels by the side of the road anywhere in England. It was that thing that just transported me. And when you talk about where you've been, the people that you come across, long way up going through Southern and Central America, then you get to what America is. And we all, regardless of what your opinion of America is, it's big, it's brash, it's right in your face. But the different cultures that you go through, it must feel like an assault on the senses, because you must have soaked so much up from around the world, different levels of humanity, different cultures, different levels of what people believe to be important. Mm. That must be quite a mind-blowing and humbling existence to be able to look back on.
Yeah, no, I think for sure. I think, and I'm sure anybody who's done a bit of traveling, regardless of where it is, in the UK or Europe or further afield, you know, there's something wonderful about doing the A to B, but it's what happens in between, and those kind of the breakdowns or the bumping into somebody or you know, something. The things that kind of slightly went wrong or you had a breakdown or puncture or something like that, and you met somebody who then helped you, you ended up going to their place or their shop to get it fixed, and you ended up meeting some people and going out or whatever. And that's what it's all about, is the people that you meet along the way. We all know we can ride from A to B, and you know, some people love to go and do, you know, 500 miles, 600 miles a day, and that's what they love to do. But for me, part of it is building into your adventure, is building in a bit of time to be able to get off the bike and have a look around where you actually are. But having said that, you know, no matter how much time you give for an adventure, it's never enough time. And you always end up running out of time, always. Yeah. And that's the big thing. You know, we met this guy, we were going up to South America, and I think we were in Guatemala or somewhere. And this motorbike, we were going north and he was going south, and we crossed and I could see him in the rearview mirror, he swung around to come and join us, and he pulled us over and we stopped, and he goes, oh, I'm glad I bumped into you two, I heard you were coming up, And he'd just come out of Mexico and was going to Guatemala. And he said, yeah, no, I'm on a 6-month tour down through South America and stuff. And I said, how's it going? He goes, well, it's taking me 4.5 months just to get here. And he said, I'm in a bit of a rush to get down to the bottom of South America.
Blast out.
He had, you know, he'd completely said he'd gotten lost in his, you know, Mexico and coming into Central America. And he's having to think, I'm going to have to extend it another 6 or 7 months. So even he had, even having 6 months, he was already under the cosh and running out of time. So that's the only thing, you know. And what I love about I meet a lot of people now, and it's become really popular, is this thing. People are buying some bikes. They go down through Central America or Africa, whatever it is, and they do their 3 or 4 weeks of riding, and then they park up, store their bikes, go home, work, and then they go back 6 months later, do another month or whatever they can, and store the bike. And that's becoming hugely popular now. And I love that idea that you can keep going, you know, and it's there's something very refreshing about it. If you've got a big, hard, stressful job or time or whatever,
break, isn't it? That is awesome.
Yeah.
And even though it's been hard work and you've been traveling a lot and it's a lot of adventure, you know, you still come back feeling fresh.
Yeah. It's a freedom, isn't it, when you get on a bike? We talk to a lot of people about it's just something different when you get on a bike. It's just like nothing else. In terms of this adventure for you, let's go back to when it kind of started. When you passed your test, was that always going to be a given since you've been riding since you were 4 or 5? You knew you'd pass your test, but was it still a magical moment? Did you think, wow, lose the L plates, get a big bike, go where I want? I'm a man. How did you feel when you passed that test?
Oh yeah, no, it was fantastic. I went out and bought a G6R 750.
Oh, nice.
And crashed it.
Oh, crap.
and then blend the tires. I was never more nervous than taking my motorcycle test. I failed the first time, because I was giving myself loads of time the first time to get to where I had to go, and I had to rent a 125. So I got to the petrol station, I was filling up, and this guy just walked past me, and he goes, oh, he said your brake light's out, and I went, what? He said, your brake light's out. And I had to go to 3 petrol stations to find a bulb. And then once I got the bulb, I didn't have a Phillips screwdriver, and I completely, so I finally got to the examination place, and like with seconds to bear. And then we went out, and I was so flabbergasted by the whole thing. I made one mistake after another and failed.
I failed my first one as well. I skidded on some leaves on an emergency stop and I failed. I was devastated. Passed my car first time, bike was second time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the thing is, I think the big difference between getting your car test and your bike test is one, when you're taking your car test, you kind of have to take your car test, you know, don't you?
Because
that's just, it's part of being functional to get around. But when you take your motorcycle test, you've chosen to do that. Yeah. And it's something you really want to do. So when you go to take your test, you're just shitting yourself most of the time. and the relief of, actually, the guy who, when I passed my test, you know, because he, you know, when you have to go around the block, and I don't know if they do it now, but it was so long ago when I had mine, and he sort of steps out in between the cars and puts his hand up, and you have to make your emergency stop. And he said to me, he said, just go around the corner, and he said, stay well below 20. And so when you do stop, you know, you're not going to skid. Anyway, so I did it, and that was fun. And then I said, well, why? I can see you. So why, you know, surely you should hide, you know. So it means, you know, and he goes, no, I know. And he said, the reason we don't hide now is because he said the guy who used to work with him, they used to hide between the cars, and so he goes go around the block. So he goes around the block, and he comes back, and the guy's lying there with another motorbike had hit him, because he was a courier, and he heard the courier come. He jumped out, put his hand up, and the guy hit him and he broke his leg. So that's why they don't hide between cars now.
I remember when I took my test, they had some intercom system and it was really rubbish. Yeah. I could hardly hear it. It was all grainy and crackly and I could hardly hear him. But I remember being really devastated that I failed the first time because I had a TZR125 Yamaha and I was ready to debore it and put a power valve system and all this stuff. And in the end, I think it's different for you, Prutz, when you took your test. But when me and Charlie did it, you could have a 125 pass. You could go out and buy an R1 or something. You could go get any bike you wanted.
Jump straight
I think
away.
It's a bit different now, but in our day, it was kind of lethal. It was brilliant. If you had the money, you could buy a big bike.
Well, it's certainly staged now, isn't it? I understand what it is because it's a safety thing, is it? But I was the same kind of. So I would have been 17, 18 years ago now, and that was literally where you, like you said, L plates go, and this Honda VT Shadow that I took up to the lakes, thinking I was. You know what I mean? Easy rider. Look behind me. There's a caravan of just cars. Look behind me. Going, look at this dickhead on this 125 that's not getting over 40 miles an hour. And then you kind of go. It's that childlike thing. If you go right, so I can get anything now. Yeah, yeah. So I can go from a 125 to a Thunderbird that's a 16. Yeah, yeah. Gosh, and you think that is mental.
Yeah. No. I mean, I remember. I'm sure when you pass your test, I became obsessed by sports bikes and I just had one after another and I had three GSXR 750s and I wrote off two of them and I kept going on these Sunday runs and I wrote this bike off and I ended up in this field and a friend of mine and I'd hit this 2x2 wooden post on my back And anyway, a friend of mine stopped and he said, you look just like a meerkat. Because he said, you came up out of the grass and sort of looked around and then went back down again. And anyway, I was waiting for the recovery truck and he said to me, look, Charlie, I think you should go and do some track days because I think you're going to kill yourself. And that's when I thought, I don't know if you guys have done track days, I'm sure. I think we spoke about track days in the past, but I went and did them, and then I've since then been completely obsessed about going off and doing track days as well, and have gone all over the country and a little bit in Europe and the Nürburgring. I've done hundreds of laps around the Nürburgring, and it's a great way to get that speed out of your system without trying to emulate it on the road.
Yeah. Definitely.
I crashed it a lot there as well. But
there's a common theme with you, Charlie, and a lot of crashing going on. You like to push it, obviously, legally.
But if you're not crashing, well, no, it's probably the lack of ability more than, you know, what is it? My enthusiasm outweighs my ability is probably the reason.
Charlie, when it comes to, I mean, obviously, you do have long-standing relationships with bike manufacturers and the ability and the access to be able to review so many. It's a real hobby of mine watching motorcycle reviews on YouTube. But given what you've ridden, I've seen you've got the Sunburst Orange Down and Out Custom, which the Down and Out boys are up kind of Rotherham way, so they're not too far from me. And I've been in there a couple of times, and Hitchcock's Exhaust, and working with people like that. Given what you've got access to, do you have your own bikes? Sounds like a daft question in the garage. And if so, what's the current stable looking like?
It's crowded. I love, obviously, you know, one of the great things about motorcycles is that certainly in this country and in a lot of other countries, the secondhand market is really good and really cheap, and you can pick up amazing stuff. So instead of sort of one expensive car, you can have four or five really, really nice bikes. And so that's my excuse, I'd say. But at the moment I've got a Ducati Desert X, which I just absolutely love. I think it's the best adventure bike I've ridden in the last 12 years. I think it's incredible and amazing for what, you know, Ducati, who are sort of more known for their sports bikes, really. And then I've got a Down and Out Thruxton, which I had sold out, who Down and Out split, and they became two entities, and so Chris then became sold out. So he did one. So the first one I did was a Thruxton a T120, and Dan and I built that orange, and that was shown at the bike shed show.
Yeah, I saw it.
It was there, which is I'm sure the bike shed show is a pretty cool place. And then sold out, built my Thruxton and changed that because I wasn't riding the Thruxton. It was all, you know, too much hanging down. And as you get older, my injuries don't allow me to spend too much time on a sports bike these days. But and then I've got a dirt bike. I've got my live wire. I've got just a bunch of other stuff.
Not only bikes, Charlie, because I've been there. It was like literally, oh, do you want to borrow a different colour helmet or do you want to borrow these levers? I think you've accumulated a lot of gear over it. It's almost like a bike shop when you come to yours. But yeah, it's amazing
well,
to no, see.
But it's well, it was lovely when you came over, and it was lovely that we had the time to be able to ride together. And since then, I've been building another shed. Since then, I don't know if I was building the shed down in the bottom there when you came. Yeah, I can't remember.
There was all sorts going on at yours, but yeah, the shed you had was. It's, by the way, Pruss, it's not a shed. It's not like I call a shed in my garden, which has got a lawnmower in it.
It's a hanger, isn't it? Yeah.
I wish it was a hanger. Well, it's a bit like that movie Field of Dreams, isn't it? If you build it, you can fill it.
The bike.
You
know?
But I thought I had a big garage, and I thought, you know, I'm going to have loads of space, and there's no space, but because I've got a couple of my father's moved in with me. He's 92 now, and he's he had to sell his house because his third wife took the rest of his money. And that's what happens when you think with your penis, you know, you lose everything. And he definitely did that all his life. But
that's still going strong.
But had a great time.
Yeah, he's had a great time doing it.
Had a great time doing it. It's like was it Burt Reynolds when he was being interviewed by, I can't remember who was interviewing him, and they said to him, you know, you lost everything. You spent all your money. You went into alcoholism, drugs, and all that kind of stuff. And you've now come out the other side. And he said, how do you feel about it? And he goes, yeah, well. And he looked really sad. He said, yeah, well, I sure had a good time. So bikes, and I kind of swapped them around a little bit and stuff. So listen, enough about my bikes, because my wife might hear this, and then I'll be in huge trouble because I have another place where I keep some bikes as well.
I love that. You're not in trouble because you've got a mistress around the corner. You're in trouble because you've got another 25 bikes hidden away in another shed.
Well, I always say to my wife, you know, buying bikes is cheaper than divorce. So,
as exemplified by your dad.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my God, that poor guy, and he'd be rich. I would have had inheritance, you know. God damn it! But listen, you guys have got lots of bikes, haven't you?
And I've been in a position where I've got one at the moment, which is a Bonneville Bobber Black, which I absolutely love, and I've had it for that long that it fits my backside. It's got all the bits that I need. It's got my quad lock charging waterproof thing.
Fantastic quad lock! What a great,
so simple
product.
Simple, but so effective. So that's all sorted. I did have. The only time that I was balancing a couple was I had an old Bonneville, which just dropped oil on the floor. And again, on the long way up, down and round theme, I had a GS Adventure. So 2007 GS Adventure, which I took everywhere, which I loved, which was, again, farkled everything. So lower pegs, comfy seat, all the stuff with it. And then I've told it on here before, took it down to Swansea where I was working for the night on a football match, came back to the hotel on the front, where I parked the bike after the match, walked up to the space where I'd left the bike and kind of went, right, it's too big for someone to arse around and move. Because if one of my colleagues has thought, do you know what, we'll move it for a laugh. It's just, if you don't know about bikes, you'd have picked it up and gone, Jesus Christ, and dropped it straight away. But I said, walked up to the gap, couldn't find it, rang the police. And it then followed to be some kind of sitcom skit where the very broadly Welsh accented woman on the phone was quizzing me about how I was going to get home. not let's try and find. She went, you're a long way from. Yes, I know I am. I'm literally miles away. I don't know how I'm going to. So it transpired, vanished, and never saw it again. So went from that to a bobber, which is a completely different thing, as you know, and a different vibe. But that's so that's my kind of where I am. But I've not seen Ewan's bike in the flesh, but on his socials and he showed me pictures. His is a thing of beauty, Charlie.
Yeah. But I'm down to one bike because I had the guilt trip moment where I sat my boy down, my 5-year-old, so I'm going to take you to the gym with me tonight. Now, I train with a guy called Scott. He's only got one leg. I said, you can ask him any questions you want, but don't stare because it's really rude. He said, oh, how did he lose his leg, Daddy? And I said, oh, actually, he was in a motorbike accident round the corner from here. And he looked me dead in the eye and said, Daddy, I don't want you to ride a motorbike ever again. And I was like, oh. So I got rid of bikes, but I did keep the one that Prats is talking about. I can't bear to sell it. Just I've got like a customized Harley, which I spent far too much on. It's a cool kind of bobber thing, and it's wicked. But I think we'll all agree, bikes. My dad got me into bikes, and because of that, I'll always have bikes. Although my son knows a danger, I've got three boys. I will definitely encourage them to ride bikes rather than horses or anything like that. So I think it's just something for me that's been passed down. And you know, it's lovely because we get to speak to people like you, Charlie, and we've all got that common bond that we love two wheels. And everyone who we've had on here are so passionate about their journeys and the people they've met through biking. I feel privileged to be a biker, to call myself a biker.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think it's a wonderful thing. I think I was just talking to you and my Ewan. Well, not mine, but...
What? Can't I be your Ewan too? Just call me Ewan.
You're Ewan too.
Charlie, just to cut in there, I was going to ask you that later on in the piece, but I was going to ask you your advice about dealing with hyperactive, extroverted, kind of life and soul of the party people called Ewan that happen to be your wingman and work colleague. And any tips about trying to keep them at bay or kind of making sure you get the best out of them?
You just got to let them go. Just embrace the embrace the beauty of it, you know. And but you know, he, I can't remember what we'd be talking about.
We were talking about meeting lovely people through bikes, you know, the common bond.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, and then the bond that we have through biking and Ewan, you know, I remember the first conversation I ever had with Ewan. We met on a film set together. We were both acting on the same film. I went up to him and I went, hey, Ewan, you know, nice to meet you. I think he'd just done Trainspotting. And I said, you know, nice to meet you. And, you know, he said, I hear you have a Moto Guzzi California. And, nice. And anyway, so 36 years later, he just sent me a text going, trying to bought another one. and so that was my last conversation I had with him was about a motorbike. And so nothing has changed in 36 years. So it's quite nice. Yeah.
You on a motorbike is, you know what I mean? It goes so hand in hand. It's how we picture you. It's how we see you in the media and across so many different platforms. Petrol station, helmet off, paying for your stuff. I mean, can you get in and out without someone going, Charlie, or someone saying, can I just have a quick, what's the desert sled like? Is it any good? And is it ever like, Christ, I've got to get somewhere. I need to get my helmet back on and get going. Because you don't strike me as a man that would be blasé about that type of thing.
And I think I'm kind of lucky. I think people do recognize me, but it's not in the same kind of league as Ewan or as other friends I know. And so I'm kind of lucky. I mean, it does happen. I mean, I think the worst is when you're asleep on a plane and someone pods you and says, I'm so sorry to disturb you. And you think, really?
And but you're happily signed,
you know. So if anybody's out there, if I am sleeping on a plane, just wait, you know.
Yeah.
But I do get shocked sometimes as I'm filtering through London or something like that. And you know, you get stuck and then someone in a car or a van or something goes, all right, Charlie. And you think, how on earth did you recognize me and out of that? So that's kind of nice. And you know, it's lovely being, and I'm sure you guys have come across it yourselves. You know, it's you know, there's nothing nicer than having your ego massaged, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think the nice thing is you're respected within the community of bikers and beyond. And you're not famous for doing, you know, going on Love Island or something, or, you know, winning the lottery. You're famous because you've made some brilliant programs and you're an actor and you've done really well.
Kind.
So, yeah. But final question time. And I think this could be an absolute belter. Maybe I know the answer already. So if you could give me that scenario or let me know, you're going to go on a dream ride so you can ride any location. What bike are you going to be on? With whom are you riding? And what is your soundtrack? So what music you're listening to, who's your best riding buddy, and what bike are you on, and what road are you on? Because you've covered it all. You've done the world.
Did a bit, to be fair.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if it's a tarmac road, I would be on a Multistrada, the new Multistrada V4, either the rally or the road version, or they've got a GT version, which is, I was just in the Ducati dealership having my bike serviced and the GT was there, and that was like, wow. But and it'll be that, and then it would be in Tasmania. I do this motorcycle tour, as we spoke about before, in Tasmania, and probably one of the best pieces of tarmac I think I've ever ridden on anywhere in the world. I mean, there's the Dragon's Tail in America, but it's only like 12 miles long, whereas this one from Hobart to the most westerly point in Tasmania, and it's to Strawn, and it's 240 kilometers long. And there's barely a twisty bit, barely a straight bit in it, and it's and it just gets twistier and twistier as you go. So the further you go to your destination, the twistier it becomes.
Nice.
And it's mountainous. It's through open ground. It's through trees. It's just, I mean, it's incredible. And so that would be a tar road. I think off road. I did the Dakar Rally in 2006 on a motorcycle, and unfortunately, I only managed 5 days and then broke my hands. But
that was plural, Charlie. You broke both hands. So
both hands. Yeah, I did finish the day with broken hands.
I saw the post you put up, because we've had people on that are so synonymous with Dakar, and you put a post on just the other day, because obviously it's that time of year, and I think it was you covered in dust. Would it be with maybe at least one pot on your?
It was two broken hands. Yeah. I mean, it was when I came in. So I crashed. I'll tell you the story quickly. I crashed on day five, and it was I was into a riverbed. And I think the reason lots of people crash on motorbikes is they're always looking at their road book. And I was looking at my road book, and it said at kilometer 225, treble danger in old riverbed. And by the time I looked up, I was in the riverbed. And anyway, lying on my ass and thinking, God, my hands hurt. And I tried to pick up the bike, and there were, and especially this hand, the right hand, it sounded like a crisp packet, you know, when you crunch up a crisp packet. Anyway, so I picked, and then Matt, one of the guys who I was riding with, he came up behind me and he put the bike on top of the riverbed to stop bikes and cars running me over. And he came down and he helped me pick up the bike, and he goes, go, go, go. So I get on the motorbike and I can sort of hold on, and I'm going along. And then I look down at my left hand, and my left thumb was just sort of flopping around. And I was thinking, shit, that's two hands. I'm thinking that's not good. And anyway, so I banged my thumb on the handlebar, and it popped back into place. And so I had about another 400 kilometers to go or something. So I thought, I'll get to the end of the day. I can sort of ride. Got to the end of the day, and it was pretty painful. And I went to the doctor's place. They have like 46 doctors and nurses, mm-hmm. and they can do operations in the middle of the desert. It's pretty amazing. And this French doctor looked at it, and he said, "Oh," he said, "Charlie," he says, "you're broken both your hands." He said, "Not only can you not ride the Dakar," he said, "I'm not even sure if you're going to be able to wipe your own ass." And he was wrong, because I could get a baby wipe on this finger, and I could just reach around. So that showed him, you know.
Made a stronger stuff, the Brits.
Yeah. You're going to say, no French men tell me I can't wipe my ass. And I would say off-road, you know, in Morocco or anywhere in Africa, there's some amazing riding. And then if you want to do some off-road amazing trails, you know, southern Spain, most of Portugal, I mean, there must be thousands of kilometers of dirt roads, and easy, hard, all sorts of dirt roads to do. It's pretty amazing.
Who are you going to go with, though? That's the question. Is it Billy?
Oh, who was going to go with?
Yeah, or anyone else?
I would go. Yeah, well, if I could go with someone, I'd love to spend a bit of time with Barry Sheen. And if I could have done that, I was at a restaurant once, and we went into this restaurant, and Barry Sheen, Damon Hill, Murray Walker, David Coulthard, a whole lot of people sitting in this table beside us, and we were on this long table of all my mates, and Barry Sheen was sitting at this table. So we came in late, and my wife and I, girlfriend at the time, sat at the end of the table, and I went off to the toilet, and I came back, and Barry was sitting there chatting my wife up. Yes. And as I walked up to behind him, all I could hear him say, he says, "Olivia, you're a gorgeous girl. Do you want to come to Australia with me?" And I tapped him on the shoulder and I said, no, my girlfriend doesn't want to go with you, but I do. And he looked at me up and down. He went like that and he went, "Nah, I don't think so." And he walked off. That was the only time I ever met him.
Oh, lovely.
But anyway.
Oh my God, that is amazing. I mean, and I'm just picturing, if you're listening to this eating your breakfast and you've just heard Charlie's description of his hands at the Dakar, we sincerely hope you managed to get to the end of your meal.
Yeah, and I hope you're not eating sausages. Yeah.
But I texted Toby Price, Sam Sunderland, who's a Dakar rider, British guy, won the Dakar twice. Yeah. And he crashed, and I texted him and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry to hear about your crash, but I did four more days than you." It didn't go down very well. But so I'm sorry, Sam, about that.
Well, you certainly made of stern stuff, Charlie. And this has just been absolutely wonderful. What a great way to kick off our new season of Full Chat. It's powered by Bikeshaw. It's the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. They will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter, or moped insurance, and so much more.
As Pratt said, what a start to Series 3. And honestly, we got the guest we wanted. He's kicked it off in absolute fashion. Thank you very much, the one and only Mr. Charlie Borman. Brilliant.
Oh, it's a pleasure, an honour to be on your show, guys. And you two are just really special people.
Oh, that's very kind. Very kind of you indeed. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. Don't forget to look at Charlie's website, charlieborman.com, to find out about all of his forthcoming expeditions and how you can get involved if you fancy a bit of that, and you, and I think we certainly do.
We certainly do. I'm sure everybody listening will as well. There's two things perhaps we need to do. Isle of Man TT and get him on a Charlie's Tours. Go with him on a bike somewhere. It will be absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Until next time. See you later.